Limited Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Do you believe in the importance of community radio?
Of course I do.
Then show your support today by donating online at kboo.fm and help us meet our fall fundraising goal of $80,000. We can only get there through the support of people like you. So donate at kboo.fm or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Give a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member today. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival from September 24th through October 1st, streaming online. The 2020 Portland Eco Film Festival features 30 films, a youth showcase, and interviews with the filmmakers. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival from September 24th through October 1st, streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today on Sprouts, part one of Voting During a Pandemic, COVID-19 and the 2020 election. Voting rights expert Dr. Michael Latner explains how science can keep us safe when casting our votes during the COVID-19 pandemic. How do we vote during a pandemic? My own state, Massachusetts, held its primary before COVID-19 caused citywide shutdowns. So while I haven't seen the pandemic's effect on voting firsthand, I did see coverage of the Wisconsin and Georgia primaries, where long lines and the sudden closure of polling stations left many voters shaken and disgruntled with the process. And you can hardly blame them. The past months have shown our country is not prepared for voting during a pandemic, at least not yet. So as November draws closer, there's a question that's become increasingly urgent. How can science help us avoid these failures in the presidential election? We tackle this question with our guest, Dr. Mike Latner, an associate professor in political science at California Polytechnic State University. And he's a former Kendall Voting Rights Fellow here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mike's an expert in the scientific measures of integrity and bias in our electoral systems. So he has a lot to say about what the pandemic has done to our voting system. So much so that we just couldn't fit it all into one episode. So we're doing a twofer, a two-part conversation about voting and COVID-19. This episode is part one, and we dig into what certain states have done right or wrong in their primaries and what we can learn from those examples. We also talk about mail-in voting and voter fraud, two topics swimming in a sea of rumors, to learn what the research actually says. While we see in this episode that many things can go wrong and have gone wrong, part two will show us that a fair and safe election this November is still possible, and that there are many things you and I can do now to make sure our states are ready. Mike, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a collective angst right now about the election in November. We're in the midst of an unprecedented pandemic. We can't predict where outbreaks will be, how bad they'll be, and the pandemic voting collision on election day is something we really need to be prepared for. So, Mike, that's where you come in. How will voting be affected by COVID-19?
Well, it's going to be affected in a number of ways, first of which is it's going to affect voter turnout. At the beginning of this year, based on surveys of voter intent and knowledge and excitability about the election, we are expecting 2020 to be a record turnout year. That in itself presents a number of challenges for election officials at the state and local level just accommodating a massive surge in voter turnout. Now you add on top of that a pandemic that is going to make voting in person dangerous, and we're basically forcing people to risk their health to exercise their franchise, and we don't want to do that. So that means that states need to come up with alternative methods of voting, such as vote by mail, so that people can vote from home, which is not a problem for several states. Indeed, five states have some experience with universal vote by mail, most notably Washington and Oregon. But in many other states, including a number of battleground states, there's virtually no experience with vote by mail. So, you know, we're talking about 5% or less of the population typically votes by mail, and those are often overseas and military voters who have to vote by mail if they're going to exercise their franchise. And so we're talking about, on the one hand, a big challenge in terms of handling a surge of voters who are interested in turning out in what's going to be a historic election, and at the same time, a huge behavioral shift in that we need to change the way that most Americans vote. And that's a massive challenge that is both an infrastructure challenge as well as a public education challenge. And then on top of that, if it were just a matter of you know, moving everyone to vote by mail, that would be a significant challenge in itself. But for various reasons, whether it's access to residential mail or disability, tens of millions of Americans are going to still need to vote in person. And so we need to make sure that people can vote safely and securely in person without risking their health. And so that presents a whole new set of challenges for especially local election officials, but state election officials as well, who are not in the, don't have the experience and the training to create medically safe environments out of polling places. And so there's a myriad of challenges that we're presented with this election year.
So, well, let me just quickly ask, I mean, we've already seen some of the chaos with the Wisconsin and the Georgia and other primary elections. So talk to me a little bit about what we saw there and what we've learned or can take away from those primaries to prepare us for November.
Sure. So the experience of holding a primary during a pandemic actually provides us with some really valuable lessons, mostly about what not to do. 16 states postponed their primaries as the pandemic began spreading across the United States. And that was itself a legal challenge for many states. A few states, like Wisconsin in particular, basically tried to postpone their election. The governor of Wisconsin attempted to do that. The state Supreme Court claimed that he did not have the power to unilaterally do that. And so they ended up holding their election. Really, voters weren't sure whether they were going to have an election the day before the primary actually began. And so what you really had was a reactionary response from state and local election officials. You had a number of emergency precinct closures. The number of precincts in the city of Milwaukee were consolidated from 85 to 5 in the largest city in the state. The state was inundated with absentee ballot requests. Voters wanted to vote by mail. The surge in vote by mail requests was so high that local election officials were unable to process all of those requests, and they didn't process them all on time. And so by the time the primary came around, you had thousands of absentee ballots that had never been delivered. That resulted in a Supreme Court challenge that resulted in many voters basically being forced, since the postmark date was not extended for those mail ballots. They hadn't received their ballots even though they requested them, and they were forced to decide whether or not to risk their health or to give up their vote.
So what ended up happening?
So what we saw on election day were very long lines in Wisconsin with the consolidated precincts. We had a lot of people who were in line for hours. That increased the exposure to the COVID virus. And we have at least one study that came out, the one comprehensive study from the National Economic Bureau of Research, that showed that 2 to 3 weeks after the date of the primary, after Election Day, indeed there was a positive association with an increase in the rate of positive cases of COVID for counties that had more people per precinct showing up. And so we have some direct evidence that there's a direct link between the level of voter congestion on election day at polling places and the risk of the spread of the disease. Similarly, in Georgia, you had a reactionary state election apparatus that was closing precincts and really struggling to process the request for mail ballots. And you had similar results, fewer precincts open, longer lines, and really people unnecessarily risking their health. And so what we learned from those two cases is that we want to be proactive. We need to provide the states with the infrastructure they need to process mail ballots and to count those mail ballots when they come in. We need to support the U.S. Postal Service that becomes essentially part of the chain of custody of mail ballots as we move people to vote by mail. There are also a couple of good examples. So the state of Nebraska, for example, held their primary a couple weeks ago, and they prepared to move people to vote by mail. They sent every eligible voter an application for an absentee ballot. There was a big public education campaign to inform people of the way that voting is changing during the primary. And they had relatively few problems on election day. Crucially, they didn't close very many precincts. So they didn't, even though they had fewer people voting in person, they had a massive surge of vote by mail, just like Wisconsin. But they also were able to process people for in-person voting with relatively few problems, in part because they had the number of voting machines, the number of polling places that they needed to have open. They also provided every polling worker with personal protection equipment. And so they ensured that the polling places were compliant with CDC health and sanitation guidelines. And they were able to pull off a primary with relatively few problems.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can find us on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org. Today, we're talking about voting in the November election in the midst of a pandemic. So in Wisconsin and Georgia, they opened fewer polling places. That seems counterintuitive. Wouldn't you want more places open so that people are less crowded?
Yeah, so that's mainly a function of the practical constraints that local election officials are facing. So on the one hand, if you're moving everyone to vote by mail, then you're not going to need the sort of in-person infrastructure that you would normally have. And you don't want to assign poll workers to polling places where very few people are showing up, because you don't want to risk the health of your public workers either. On the other hand, it is, and this is the real reason, comes in terms of the constraints that we're seeing election officials facing. It's very hard to find poll workers. Poll workers are disproportionately elderly and retired people, and they are most at risk of infection, so we don't want to put them in polling places. A number of polling places around the country tend to be senior centers and community buildings and places where high-risk populations might be close to other populations, so we want to avoid that. And that's resulted in making it harder for election officials to actually find adequate polling places and places that are compliant with CDC health guidelines. There's a lot of complexity there in terms of working out where polling places can be safely put up and how long they can be put up. One of the additional requirements that we're looking for is for states to expand early voting. So we want early in-person voting at polling precincts. We're looking for, 2 weeks would be great if states could provide that. And the goal there is to flatten the curve on election day. So we don't want, if people need to vote in person, we don't want everyone to show up on election day. We'd like to flatten out that curve so that people have a week or 2 weeks that where they can vote in person early. The problem, of course, is finding a place that you can set up, either a private or commercial residence that can be set up for early voting. And those are hard to find, and it's making the job of election officials quite difficult. I would like to add, though, that there have been some innovations, certainly some policy innovations that we're encouraging in the UCS reports are partnerships with private and commercial enterprises. So you may have heard LeBron James this week is working with the NBA to encourage opening up stadiums as voting places. The Atlanta Hawks have already agreed to open up their stadium on Election Day as a massive voting place. And that's the kind of innovation that we really need, because if we're going to practice social distancing especially, it's really important that we're able to process voters efficiently. And in the places where that's hardest to do, and we know this from past research, and this is in the new UCLA Voting Rights Lab report, is that the wait times and the longer that people wait in line are not distributed equally across the population. Specifically, urban voters in densely populated districts, voters of color, voters with disabilities, they're more likely to experience problems at a polling place. They're more likely to experience longer wait times. And in many cases, these are the same populations that are at higher risk for COVID infection, and the death rates are higher among these same populations. And so if we don't address these inequities in voter congestion, what we can expect is an amplification of the existing racial disparities and other disparities that we already see in COVID death rates.
And you're talking about the report Protecting Public Health in the 2020 Election, is that right?
That's right.
Right. So this is a new report that just came out that I was reading this morning before our conversation, and I highly recommend it. It's got some really great resources in it as well for people to look at where your state is, and you can also find, you know, things that you can do. I think it's interesting, you know, maybe we need to encourage young and healthy people to volunteer at polling places.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the Science Rising site has a tool, TurboVote.
I just did TurboVote this morning when I was looking at all the materials. I just went in there and I ordered up my ballot. And I mean, I love going to the polls on Election Day because I just think it's exciting to go there and do that, but not this year.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I live in California, so I am a permanent absentee voter, but my habit, and this is partially because I just, you know, like the social experience, is to fill out my ballot at home, and then I go to the polling place in the morning and I drop it off. I drop off my whole family's ballots. And it's an important part of the election experience, you know, but just like so much of our social lives has changed over the last few months, we have to do things differently this year because we should not be risking people's health to exercise the franchise. And so we need to make these changes and these adjustments. And we know what to do. We know the cause of long lines and voter congestion. And so what we need to do is implement the tools that we can use to reduce voter congestion and still provide a robust voting experience.
Why is mail-in voting so controversial? I feel like we have science that supports that mail-in ballots, that they work. Why are they so controversial?
Yeah, the question over the safety of vote by mail is something that has been, frankly, made a controversy because there are certain political figures that have been casting evidence-free claims about the dangers of vote by mail, specifically with regard to voter fraud. UCS and the UCLA Voting Rights Project, along with the University of New Mexico School of Social Policy, collaborated on a report earlier this summer. And we actually look at all of the data available from the Heritage Foundation, which is itself a conservative think tank. So we're using the data that, you know, doesn't come from progressive sources or anything like that. And, you know, we demonstrate pretty clearly that for the states that have moved to vote by mail, there's no evidence of significant increase in voter fraud or election fraud more broadly. And when we look across states that have traditionally used a lot of vote by mail, what we find is that the danger, if anything, is that the rejection rates are higher. And by rejection rate, I mean the ballots that don't get counted. And part of that is a function of the signature requirement. So when you vote by mail, typically you have your signature that's recorded on your on the voter registration list, and the signature that you sign on your mail ballot that you return, the envelope, is matched against that signature. And if those signatures don't match, then that ballot's not counted. And so what we actually see is that states that use a lot of vote by mail have higher ballot rejection rates, if anything else. I would also add that vote by mail is a way of providing a paper ballot. Every ballot, you know, has a physical reality to it that some types of voting don't have. And so in that sense, mail ballots actually add an additional layer of security, particularly with regard to hacking and auditing. There is a verifiable ballot that can be checked.
So how do you commit fraud with vote by mail?
Well, there are a couple of ways. Folks that are claiming that vote by mail is dangerous typically make the case that voters themselves are going to either be sent ballots when they shouldn't. That is, people that are not eligible to vote are going to be sent ballots, and then those votes will be counted when they shouldn't. Or that there's going to be some kind of ballot stuffing where political campaigns might collect ballots that aren't filled out by voters and fill them out themselves. And indeed, we do have evidence that this has occurred. I mean, voter fraud is a real thing. Most recently, there was a local election in New Jersey where there were about 3,000 or so votes that were the irregularity in the patterns of the votes being turned in revealed that there was a local election official engaged in election fraud. And then in 2018, probably the most famous recent example was the North Carolina 9th Congressional District race actually had to be invalidated and rerun because the Republican candidate in that race was using campaign officials that were collecting ballots and then either throwing them out if they were Democratic ballots or filling out blank ballots. And so in both those cases, I think the important lesson to learn is that in neither of those cases were voters themselves actually involved in fraud. So it wasn't illegal voters that were casting illegal ballots. It was political campaigns and it was election officials that were actually engaged in fraud. And this is what we find is much more common across all types of election fraud.
So individuals aren't doing this?
Typically, it's election administrators that are engaged in fraud or political campaigns. It's rarely, if ever, voters. Most of the convictions for voter fraud, voter impersonation fraud, are largely the result of error. People that are voting in two states and they don't know that they're not eligible, or people voting when they're on parole and they're not eligible to vote, things like that. So the bottom line is that even in the cases of New Jersey and North Carolina, it's important to note that these cases were discovered with relatively low numbers of ballots being cast inappropriately, and it's because we can detect fraud. We know forensic election science is pretty good at detecting irregular patterns of ballot returns. And so when these things do happen, we tend to catch them. And the number of voter and election fraud cases overall and the number of ballots that have been cast inappropriately are, we're really talking about thousands of ballots out of millions and millions of ballots cast. And so there's virtually no evidence that any kind of election fraud actually affects the turnout or affects the outcome of elections, except in those two cases that we have.
Mike, thanks for joining me, and I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation on the next episode. Definitely want to hear your thoughts on what might happen if people don't mail in their ballots and what we can all do to help protect our democracy. We'll be dropping that episode in 1 week, but don't go away just yet. It's time for This Week in Science History with Katie Love.
This Week in Science History, we're going back to July 25th, 1972, when an Associated Press story ran in the Washington Star and was on the front page of the New York Times the very next day, under the headline, "Syphilis Victims in U.S. Study Went Untreated for 40 Years." This was the first time the mainstream media would address the now infamous Tuskegee study. The attention and outrage from the articles, and those that followed, led to congressional hearings and an official review of the study, which was ultimately shut down that year. Most people know the broad outlines of the Tuskegee study. Starting in 1932, medical workers with the U.S. Public Health Service tracked 600 black men in rural Alabama, 399 with syphilis and 201 without. However, the men were not told what the study was for. In fact, those diagnosed with syphilis weren't even told their diagnosis. Instead, participants were simply told that they had, quote, bad blood. Yet despite the fact that penicillin was discovered to be a cure for syphilis 10 years into the study and became widely available 5 years later, the life-saving drug was not offered to any of the participants, all so the doctors could track how the untreated disease made its way through their bodies. Throughout the course of the study, several dissenters tried to speak out against the ethical issues inherent to the work. Medical practitioners from both within and outside the U.S. Public Health Service raised concern with the study authors and leaders within the PHS. But it wasn't until a whistleblower, Peter Buxton, went to the press that real change happened. By then, fewer than 75 of the men who received no treatment were still alive. And the victims extended to the wives and children of the untreated men, many of whom contracted syphilis from their husbands or were born with congenital syphilis. And that's not where the damage ends. In fact, we're seeing some of it playing out with COVID-19. Thanks to what's known as the Tuskegee effect, black people in the U.S. often mistrust the medical system and are less likely to see a doctor over a health issue than members of other minority groups, which could be playing a part in the unequal health outcomes they're seeing in this pandemic. And while the medical and science establishment has worked to correct some of the ethical issues behind the study, most notably by requiring informed consent for any participants in clinical trials and other studies involving human participants, the racism underlying the study has not been eradicated. In fact, the legacy of racism and white supremacy continues to distort science today, such as the persistence of racist theories of intelligence and the significant gaps in medical knowledge and healthcare outcomes for communities of color, driven in large part by decades of research focused primarily on white men.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to part one of Voting During a Pandemic, COVID-19 and the 2020 election. If you like what you heard, you can find the Got Science podcast on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org. Our program's executive producer was Rich Hayes, with editing by Omari Spears and Brian Middleton, writing and research by Jiayu Liang and Pamela Worth. This Week in Science History was brought to you by Katie Love. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Colleen MacDonald from the Got Science podcast in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today on Sprouts, part two of voting during a pandemic, COVID-19 and the 2020 election. Voting rights expert Dr. Michael Lattner explains how science can keep us safe when casting our votes during the COVID-19 pandemic. If you tuned in last week, you heard part one of our episode on how we can vote safely this November during a pandemic. Last week's episode covered a wide range of problems with our electoral system, not just problems that are unique to these times of COVID-19, but also the problems that have existed in our system for generations. This week, we're focusing on the solutions, what we can do to ensure equitable and safe access for every voter. Dr. Michael Lattner is an associate professor in political science at California Polytechnic State University and a Kendall Voting Rights Fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists. In part two, he tells us about the evidence-based solutions for the problems we face and what it will take to implement these solutions. Spoiler, like most things, it's money and time. And he encourages each of us to get involved however we can, from advocating for voter reform with your own state officials to handing out ballots at the polls on election day. And of course, the most important thing this election, making sure you can vote by mail. Mike, is it conceivable that the election in November could be postponed?
So the presidential election could only be postponed with enormous difficulty at the federal level. The date for the election is set by federal law, that is Congress, and it's been set since 1845. So in order for the federal government to change the election date, a law would have to be passed by Congress, that is both houses. It would have to be signed by the president, and then it would have to survive numerous court challenges. So it's very unlikely that at the federal level you would see that change. The president could try to use emergency powers to do so, but even then, it's state legislatures really are the important actors here, because they can arguably control the timing and manner of elections as set by the Constitution. So you could get some state legislative action that might try to postpone the election. But even there, of course, you're talking about, you know, a multi-state attempt to postpone or delay the election. So that would be very difficult.
So it's highly unlikely, but can you imagine a scenario where the election would be postponed? I mean, I guess what I'm really curious about is if there's anything spelled out in the Constitution outlining what should happen if we couldn't have our election.
No, not really. I mean, there's a presupposition that there are going to be regularly held elections. I mean, we've held elections in times of difficulty and even emergency. We've held an election during the Civil War. We held an election during the last major flu pandemic in the early part of the 20th century. So the most likely scenario, if the president was going to try to postpone the election, would be to use his emergency powers and to issue a memorandum or executive order to postpone or delay the election results. But that would immediately be challenged in court.
So it would be unprecedented for an election to be postponed, and sounds like pretty much impossible. But are there things going on in individual states that give you pause?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing a number of efforts on the parts of states to control their electorates, as they often do. And so one of the things that we're seeing is a kind of bifurcation of how election laws are being changed in anticipation of the November election under the conditions of the COVID pandemic. And so many states are expanding their registration deadlines. They're sending all voters absentee ballots, or more frequently, they're sending all of their voters applications to apply for an absentee or mail ballot. But then there are a number of other states, such as Texas and Wisconsin and several states that are actively seeking to not lift up voter restrictions. Alabama as well. So several states are still requiring voters to have witness or notary signature requirements to apply and submit absentee ballots. And there are a number of states that are working in the opposite direction. That is, rather than making it easier to vote and trying to provide an equal opportunity for all voters to cast a safe and secure ballot, we are definitely seeing some states that are, at a minimum, not lifting restrictions, and in some cases, not acting to provide the infrastructure and the support that local election officials need in order to secure the right to vote for all voters. So, for example, the Attorney General of Texas achieved something of a victory in the Supreme Court recently when the Supreme Court allowed the Attorney General to not expand no-excuse absentee voting. So in Texas, you still have to have an excuse or be 65 or older to apply for an absentee ballot. That was challenged under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, and the Supreme Court upheld that the states can control that. So those are the sorts of tactics and techniques that you're likely to see and that we're already seeing as we head into the election.
What is the worst case scenario for the November election?
Oh, it gets pretty bad, actually. So the worst case scenario is really just one of uncertainty. That is, we have a lot of confusion and a lot of chaos around the election itself. That is, we've got very long lines. You've got people that are either don't show up because they don't want to risk their health, or we have people that do show up and then they leave because they're waiting in line for so long. And that makes the quality of the votes cast uncertain. We won't have a representative sample or a robust turnout that we can be confident that the election results reflect the will of the people. In addition to that, if we have a surge of vote by mail coming into states that are not prepared to process those, that's going to take a long time to process those ballots. And even with in-person voting, long election lines on election night means that those ballots are going to take longer to count, which means that we won't know who the winner is of various contests, including the presidency, on election night. And you compound that with the fact that we might have major problems with processing those ballots if states don't have the equipment that they need to process those ballots adequately. They don't have the training or the poll workers. And what that creates is uncertainty. We don't really know how confident we can be in the results. And if we don't know how confident we can be in the results, and if parties and agents that are interested in using that uncertainty for their own political gain have an opportunity to point to those irregularities, then people can use that uncertainty to get the election that they're looking for. That is, to claim that there's widespread voting fraud, to make all kinds of unsubstantiated claims, and to claim authority, to claim power, when we really don't know who the winner of the election is. That's the worst possible outcome.
I agree with you. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, no, it really is about as bad as it can get. I mean, this is how democracies die. When there's uncertainty over the process, and when people and groups have an incentive to use that uncertainty for their own political ends, to either claim authority that they may not necessarily have, or to refuse to cede authority, even when the election results are somewhat clear. Any kind of uncertainty gives leverage to those who would seek to either obtain or retain power without the legitimacy of the election.
Well, I'm glad we've talked about the worst case scenario here, because hopefully that will incentivize people to act now. And you did mention that getting Congress to act on the HEROES Act is really important. So I want to talk a little bit about solutions. It sounds like the work that needs to be done to make the election in November, it seems pretty straightforward. How do we get there? How do we do it?
Well, the first thing that we need to do is to get Congress to act. In the CARES Act, which was the first COVID bill, Congress allocated about $400 million for election infrastructure for all the states. And several studies, the Brennan Center and several other organizations have actually calculated out the need to scale up vote by mail and to provide the needed safety and security infrastructure for all 50 states. And the number there is closer to $4 billion. So what we're looking for with the next COVID bill, which is the HEROES Act, is an additional $3.6 billion that would be allocated across two states according to their needs. That would provide local election officials with the resources they need to actually scale up. And there really is no alternative to this because states don't have, especially in this economic climate, you know, as you can imagine, states don't have the extra resources needed to build their infrastructure out. And so states are really in a very difficult position in terms of having their budgets slashed and at the same time needing to scale up their election infrastructure. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. The second thing that needs to happen is that that money needs to have very clear guidelines and targeted allocations. So we know what works. We need to provide voters more options. So every state needs to provide voters with the option to vote by mail. States that have more options for voting have shorter lines. There's less congestion, less risk of infection on election day. So those options should include vote by mail. They should include early voting. And they should include a robust and safe way to vote in person on election day for voters that need that. So those are the three options that voters need. We also know that in order to reduce congestion and waiting time, we need to expand points of service to the greatest extent possible. And so even though states may be forced to consolidate precincts, we need to the extent that it's possible, ensure that the number of voting machines per precinct is maximized given safety standards, because the points of service affect the time to vote. And if we can reduce the time that it actually takes to check in and to cast a ballot and to move through the line, we can greatly reduce the length of line and waiting time. And that reduces the time of exposure to the disease with other people. So we want to expand points of service, expand options, and reduce the transaction time for voting. If we can do those three things, we can ensure that we'll have a safe and healthy election. And with the additional infrastructure funding, we can ensure that the processing of those ballots is done in a way that's equitable. And we need those national standards in place to ensure that the process, for example, of verifying ballots as they come in, processing those ballots in a timely manner, and ensuring that that when there's a question of a valid ballot, that states should err and local election officials should err on the side of the voter. That is, if there's as a two-party system where you've got multiple judges evaluating ballots, if there's something wrong with a voter's ballot, they should have the opportunity to correct it. So we need requirements and standards that allow voters to be contacted in a timely manner if there's a problem with their ballot, and they have both the methods and the time needed to correct that problem.
So, Mike, what would an example of a problem with a ballot be?
Well, let's say someone forgets to sign the back of their envelope. Right? You've got a lot of people that are going to be voting by mail for the first time in their lives. That means that we're going to have a higher number of problems with ballots. People that either forget to sign the back of their envelopes before they mail it, or they don't put on the postage if the state doesn't pay for the postage, or if the signature doesn't match. For any of those reasons, those votes won't count unless the voter is given an opportunity to correct those problems. And we have best practices. States like Colorado and Oregon have really well-designed practices. They've developed a vote-by-mail systems over years rather than months. And so they notify voters within a few days if there's a problem with the ballot. And they allow multiple methods from photo ID to sending back in a new ballot with an adequate signature to, you know, they provide various ways for voters to verify that they are who they say they are. And that's really important. And that's why we need standards that put the burden on local officials to reject a ballot rather than putting the burden on the voter.
Is vote by mail supported in a bipartisan way?
Yes. In fact, the small group of individuals that are making these unsubstantiated claims about vote by mail are not representative of any political party or ideology. And so one of the lead signatories to our expert letter that went out, that was a collection of health and election experts, included Trevor Potter, who is the president of Campaign Legal Center and is a noted conservative, and was legal counsel to John McCain's presidential campaigns and was appointed by Republicans to head the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission. There are a number of organizations, Protect Democracy being another that we work with, that includes many notable conservatives and Republicans, including the Republican Secretary of States for many of the states, Utah, Oregon, and Washington, that run universal vote by mail. So they have the experience, they know that it works, and they support expanding it nationwide.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can find us on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org. Today, we're talking about voting in the November election in the midst of a pandemic. So I want to go back to what we were talking about. We touched on this a little bit earlier, and that is that people who are more at risk, people who live in urban areas, often communities of color, people with disabilities, that they are, you know, at a higher risk of contracting COVID-19 when going to cast their vote in person. Are the measures that you talked about, will it address those issues?
Yes. The goal should be to reduce wait times and reduce length in line, because that's the time that people are spending with one another, even with social distancing, right? That's the most dangerous time. The overall risk of infection is a function of the risk factors for any given environment, and that has to do with social distancing and being in an enclosed versus open environment and things like that, versus the time spent in that environment. And so the thing that we are most looking to reduce is the overall risk. And what we found in years of political science research has demonstrated that those particular voters and that the voting precincts in densely populated areas, in precincts where there's a higher percentage of voters of color and the like, that's where the long lines occur. And so if we're going to reduce the average overall risk, we need to reduce the wait time and the time that voters spend together. The average time spent voting is only about 10 minutes. But in those particular precincts, the voting times are anywhere from 30% to 100% longer on average. And so if we can reduce wait times by addressing the number of options that voters have and the preparedness of the precincts, the resources, so having enough voting machines, being able to process voters efficiently and process votes efficiently, that will address those disparities directly. You know, if you think about averages versus extremes, the average time to vote is fairly short, but it's in a small number of precincts and frankly in a small number of states where we see these really long wait times of an hour, hour and a half. And it's, you know, only about 1 in 20 voters has to wait more than a half an hour, but those are the voters that are most at risk of infection. And we know where those precincts are. We know the types of precincts and we know how to fix that problem. And so that's where our resources should be directed.
Are there other things that individuals can do?
Oh, there's so much that individuals can do. Thank you for asking. So, number one, people need to update their registration. They need to make sure that their registration is updated. They need to make sure that their friends' registration is updated and their neighbors and their coworkers, and everyone needs to make sure that they're eligible to vote, because the normal process of voter registration, there's been a wrench thrown in that whole situation because people can't canvass voters, they can't do all of the in-person, face-to-face work that is a normal part of any election cycle.
In order to do that, mm-hmm. if I want to do that, I can go to TurboVote, and I can just talk to my friends, email them, social media, put that out there. That's how I would go about doing that.
That's right. Yeah, just remind everyone to make sure that they're eligible to vote, and to as many people as possible, if the option is there, you need to request an absentee ballot. So we want to move people from voting in person to voting by mail wherever it's possible. It's a lot easier in some states than in other states, but there's been an increasing number of states, as our 50-state report shows. A number of states have taken action to make it easier to vote by mail. We need to take advantage of those changes, and we need to ensure that every voter that's able to can vote by mail in order to reduce the level of voting congestion and long lines on election day. So that's sort of individual preparation that needs to be made. But in addition to that, Americans and all residents, whether they're eligible voters or not, can work to make sure that their state election laws are as open as possible. And so you should write letters to your editor. You should go to UCS and see where your state is in terms of preparedness for the election, and then take action. Try to use your powers as a resident and as a voter to get election laws changed. That's another major hurdle that needs to be overcome, and we only have a few months left to do it. The final thing I would add is that you can serve. You can make a difference. One of the biggest challenges that local election officials face this year is a dearth of polling workers. So you can use websites like We Can Vote, the Power to the Polls, Empower the Polls app. You can figure out where your local election officials are. You can sign up to be a poll worker. You can sign up to be a staff member, and you can help be part of the process to make sure that if you are not a high-risk COVID individual, you can take part in the process and you can help fill some of those gaps that local officials so desperately need filled.
Well, Mike, that's great. I think I might look into that myself.
It's a fantastic tool. Yeah, We the Vote, We Can Vote is doing a lot of things. They also provide resources to figure out what the election laws are in your state. The Voting Rights Lab also has a great state's voting rights tracker that you can use that we're partnering with. And so there are a number of resources out there, but we need to get everyone involved in this election. Indeed, I would argue that we need something like, you know, a nationalization of our election. Our election is in real dire straits, and the quality of our democracy is really being threatened. And so this is a time for people to step up and serve.
Well, I have a follow-up from my Turbo Vote activity last week. I got my application to apply for an absentee ballot. Here in Massachusetts, typically you have to have a reason, but they've changed that for this election year, so anyone can get a mail-in ballot. And I'm hoping that it works really well, and that's just how we handle things, you know, moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that the most efficient method from a administration perspective would be to send every eligible voter a ballot. And Massachusetts has moved in that direction, as has Vermont, California. But other states have done what's sort of the second best, which is to send and allow everyone to apply for an absentee ballot. I think it's important to note that is not as good of an option, in the sense that it adds another administrative hurdle. So you've got another piece of paperwork that has to be completed and sent, and in any sort of barrier, any extra administrative step that needs to be taken is going to have an effect on turnout. That is, we know from a lot of political science research that every additional barrier, when you add a cost to voting, that has an effect, and it typically has an effect on voters with lower socioeconomic status. So for voters where it's hard to vote anyways because it's hard to find the time or take the time off, or fill out the application, you're increasing the odds of there being an error in the application. You're increasing the odds of human error, that the application might not be processed or processed correctly. And so the goal for states should really be to remove as many hurdles as possible in order to give everyone in the United States, regardless of where they live, the same chance to have their voice heard.
So keep it simple, just mail people their ballots.
That's what I would recommend, and that would be the most efficient administrative procedure and the easiest for voters.
Mike, do you have any plans for election night?
I'm going to be safely at home, hopefully celebrating with my family and with a couple of local elected officials, hopefully. That's what Zoom is for.
Right, indeed. Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. This is, we've gone from worst case scenario to how to save our democracy. I'm feeling hopeful that we will get there, that we'll make the preparations, and you know, it'll be chaotic, but I think the will of the people, I think we can do it.
I have no doubt that we can. And you're absolutely right. One of the silver linings here is that even though this is an emergency situation and that the pressure is being put on, many of these reforms can help us to permanently open up our political system and make it more voter friendly and ensure the rights of each and every voter.
Great. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks for your time.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to part two of Voting During a Pandemic, COVID-19 and the 2020 election. If you like what you heard, you can find the Got Science podcast on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org. Our program's executive producer was Rich Hayes, with editing by Omari Spears and Brian Middleton, writing and research by Jiayu Liang and Pamela Worth. The show is hosted by me, Colleen MacDonald. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Colleen MacDonald from the Got Science podcast in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I hope you've enjoyed today's program. You can find more info about the Got Science podcast at gotsciencepodcast.org. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving.